The Murthy law firm has been clarifying US immigration laws and procedures for foreign nationals since 1994. We are happy to offer this free service. Please listen to copyright information and restrictions at the end of this recording.
Hi, welcome to the Murthy Law Firm teleconference series. Today we're going to discuss the topic of business immigration related issues if Trump is elected to office. Keep in mind that when we made these plans to have these teleconferences, we had planned that it was going to be Biden versus Trump till about just over a month ago, I think till late July 2024. And obviously now we have Harris in the race, Kamala Harris, and so we are probably going to try to figure out and glean her immigration policies in a follow-up conversation with you all. So today we will go over what we understand and based on our research at the Murthy Law Firm of the potential impacts that could happen of a second Trump administration on U.S. immigration policy. And joining me today, of course, are two of my esteemed colleagues at the Murthy Law Firm, Kevin Andrews and Jeffrey Galkin. Brilliant lawyers, smart, astute people. They've really had to figure out to do some of this research from different talks and meetings and interviews on what the policies very well could be. And basically, we're also going to go over the general conservative philosophy on immigration and how a U.S. president is able to directly or indirectly, for that matter, create certain changes in laws and policies that could impact all of us, whether you're employers or employees or individuals going through the process. We're also going to try and share examples of policy changes that occurred during the first Trump administration, because we expect that some of those strategies may continue either similarly or in a modified form. As I said, our goal is to share some insights with you on what we think could be the policies that could affect all of us as immigration stakeholders. So, you know, just by a little bit more by way of background, we always say that the U.S. is a nation of immigrants. In fact, it has been shown that America is home to more international migrants than any other country in the world, which really proves the point that we are a nation of immigrants, because nearly 20% of global migrants live just in the United States of America. And if we recall, going back to 2016, right, almost 8 years ago, Trump had created something with a populist agenda of what we call MAGA, Make America Great Again movement, to restore the perceived loss of like America's global influence, and to try to seal the southern border, because the focus was domestically and internationally to focus on America and Americans and almost close off our borders like presidents have done pre-World War II. And then we also have, of course, the whole focus on legal immigration, and the policies want to focus on eliminating family and asylum and diversity visa and victim based. They want to focus on merit-based immigration system. I know Trump would talk a lot about how fantastic Canada's merit-based or points-based system was. So that's something that potentially may come back. We're not sure, but there's definitely a great focus on dealing with illegal immigration, the crossings of the border, the challenges of illegal immigration, and possibly them taking away the jobs, from the working classes, I guess, and the rise in undocumented entry. So it's a really whole bunch of stuff going on. But I think it would be very helpful if Kevin, who actually did a ton of research with me back when President Barack Obama was going to become President of the United States, and he helps with this beautiful slide presentation, which we then presented at the University of Minnesota in Minneapolis, and I actually went to Tel Aviv in Israel to speak at the U.S. Embassy on, you know, the Obama immigration policies. So, Kevin, I'm going to invite you to share some of your great wisdom and knowledge in this area, because I know this is a topic of great interest to you. on how a president is able to influence immigration policy and the limits on any such policy.
Yeah, thank you, Sheila. So, you know, what's really interesting, I think, looking back now over at least the last 24 years, you know, the 21st century, is that despite the immigration laws themselves being relatively the same that they've been since, you know, the 90s and the 60s, when some of these, the INA and Immigration Act after came out, is that the laws don't change, but man, the policies sure do change over the course of administrations, because how, you know, things were under the Bush administration, then to the Obama administration and the Trump administration and the Biden administration has been very different over the years. But you look back and say, well, the laws themselves really haven't changed. So, but like a quick crash course, immigration law, like laws are passed by Congress, as, you know, civics 101. But like for example, the H-1B lottery numbers, it's an annual limit of 65,000 for regular cap and then the 20,000 for master's cap. Congress passed a law once in, Sheila, what was it, like 2003, I think, when there was a temporary bump to like 195,000 numbers. And, you know, that required an act of Congress. And
early 2005.
Yeah, right, exactly. And then it went back to the, you know, the pre-law numbers. And so that required an act of Congress, law signed by the president. And I guess anybody that's like a casual observer of American politics these days, is like, wow, how hard is it to get Congress to agree on something for the president to sign to become law? So and usually when there is a law that's passed, what Congress says and what the specifics and, you know, the specific situations that arise are vastly, you know, different. Green card portability is a good example of that. AC 21 that said you can move your green card case from one employer to another if you're green card application was pending 180 days or more. It's the same or similar job. But all these different situations came up. What if the I-140 hasn't been approved yet? What if, you know, it's in different occupational SOC code? And the law itself said nothing about those things. So that's where regulations come in, where the agencies say, okay, we're going to make some interpretations of what Congress meant. And these are the rules. These are the regulations that we're going to use to interpret these rules, these laws passed by Congress. And there's a rulemaking process. There's something called the Administrative Procedures Act that sets the rules for making rules. But that's how we see, I think, policy change or evolve, however you want to interpret that, from administration to administration, is through those regulatory changes. Like one big one is the 60-day grace period. H-1B 60-day grace period was not a thing until January 2017, because the outgoing Obama administration quickly went through a rulemaking process that implemented a 60-day grace period that was interpreted to be a reasonable interpretation of the law, that you can have that for somebody transitioning to a new job or a different status. And I think it was like 3 days before Trump took office that this regulation was finalized. And final regulations are kind of like it's difficult toothpaste to put back into the tube, administratively speaking. So it's not impossible. It just requires more notice and comment, regulatory rulemaking process to go through. And that can be tough for agencies. So I think the focus with the Trump administration was to look at other things, look at other ways to make policies they didn't like more difficult. Like maybe the increasing processing times or things like that. So, but regulations are the next level. But I think after regulations, presidents could also, you know, engage in, and I think we've seen that as a popular thing lately, is executive orders. And Jeffrey, did you want to talk about executive orders a little bit and how that works?
Yeah, sure. So executive orders, so the statutes, regulations, those require other parties, you know, Congress to be involved, and the agency have to go through whatever steps to promulgate a regulation. But an executive order is great for a sitting president. It's a very powerful tool and essentially is entirely within the president's ability to issue. And what an executive order does, it doesn't create a law, but it directs government agencies on how to apply immigration laws. And so an example of this during the Trump administration, there's probably the most high profile immigration executive order was the Trump travel ban. And Trump was able to sign that executive order, and those travel bans went into effect. They were challenged in court, but there was nothing stopping him from issuing that executive order. And just to demonstrate the fickle nature of executive orders, so just like a president can issue an executive order without any obstacle, he could also, a president could also reverse a prior executive order with a new executive order. So an interesting example of this is, so President Obama issued an executive order that required for 80% of non-immigrant visa applicants to be interviewed within 3 weeks of receipt of their application. And Trump issued an executive order that reversed that. So they're not permanent, and they, you know, they can, executive orders can be easily changed, but in the short term, they could have a significant impact. And another way a president can directly influence immigration law and policy is by appointing either different officials to lead government agencies, or also nominating federal judges to the federal courts. And directors or, you know, secretaries who are at the top of different agencies, they can, you know, they're having a direct influence on, you know, the day-to-day policies of a particular agency. So, you know, the Department of Homeland Security, for example, and then the federal courts, a law can be passed, but often if there's a lawsuit, a federal law has to be interpreted. And who's interpreting the federal law? It's going to be a federal judge. And so there's a lot of influence on immigration law, because that's all federal, that a federal judge can have. So another thing just that's worth mentioning about who could be involved in an administration, there's been a lot of coverage, you know, over the past couple of months about Project 2025. This is a proposal, of different conservative policies that a conservative president should implement. The Trump administration disavowed Project 2025, but that doesn't mean that the policies don't align with what a conservative presidential administration would want to do. So there are different.
I think it's important also to point out, like Project 2025. It's a Heritage Foundation kind of like roadmap for what our conservative wish list, right? And this is something that it's not new. It's just something that something like a 1,000-page document that talks about a variety of different things, like getting rid of the Department of Education, Federal Department of Education, which has kind of been a conservative wish list thing for many years. In fact, Heritage Foundation criticized the Reagan administration for not coming in and getting rid of the Department of Education. So it's not like a lot of this stuff is like particularly new. Where it comes to like the immigration component, though, I think that there are pieces of it that might be useful tea leaf reading for like what we could expect from a conservative administration or a Trump administration specifically, and like the merit-based point system for for green cards issuance is one of those things that we've heard not just from Trump but from Canada and also from a lot of Democrats on big picture immigration. When it comes to like H-1B, I think one of the things that they would like to do is make that more of a higher skilled, best and brightest program, as opposed to a minimally qualified, have a bachelor's degree type of program. That would require congressional action too. So I think a lot of the fear or criticism or clickbait maybe about Project 2025 and like this need to connect it to Trump, is a lot of it is well founded, but it's part of a much larger conservative agenda that's not really tied to any specific president, you know?
Right. I think this is a great discussion by both Jeffrey and Kevin. Thank you for that. And, you know, what are some of the other general changes that we can expect? So generally, we've talked, as happened in the prior Trump administration, with increased processing time for different applications. If you recall, I-485 adjustment of status applications, H-1B petitions, H-4s, expect a lot more requests for evidence or RFEs, notice of intentions to deny, greater scrutiny, higher evidentiary burdens. People who were in the U.S. back then 10, 15, 20 years on H-1 status were getting denials of their H-1 extensions, if you recall, right? Also during the last Trump administration, the one and only Trump administration that he had, a lot of Department of State or officers or consular officers actually quit because they were cutting down and letting go of a lot of the consular officers around the globe, and that greatly increased visa processing times at U.S. consulates. So you have all of these sort of general changes going on, plus, you know, to start off the discussion with potential changes to non-immigrant visas, for example, and Kevin, I'll have you jump in if you can on the H-1B program, but I'll start off with the F-1. So for F-1, you know, they would look, we expect a much greater scrutiny on national security type of issues rather than just getting the visa issued and bringing in oodles and oodles of money into the U.S. economy, pumping it in, which international students have been doing for decades. Because,
and you know, Sheila, I think the mindset there, like the perspective is like, remember, why is F-1 different? Why is there a SCV program for those non-immigrants? And why is ICE running it? It's like, you know, 9/11, remember? Like, that's when we made these changes. And so, you know, getting away from looking back to like that as a national. Now, since then, it's not like we've been having terrorist students or anything. That was an exceptional thing and an exceptional time. But I think that's their justification to be like, well, that's why we need to be looking at it like this from a national security lens, more so than a, like you said, like stimulating the academic economy type of thing.
Yep, exactly. So let's jump from the F-1 to the H-1B if you want, Kevin.
Well, with H-1B, what we saw last time is a much higher denial rate and a much higher RFE issuance rate. The RFEs, you know, that could just be, you know, just making it harder to get the same, you know, thing. We're just going to ask you to give us more detail about the job duties. You give us 10 pages of job duties in the initial filing. We want to see 20 pages of job duties explanation in the RFE response. That part was sort of administratively unavoidable. But the thing that I think was really felt very frustrating at the time was the higher denial rate. I think some numbers that I saw was, you know, pre-2016, the denial rate was like maybe 1-5%, you know, 1 for your big tech and 5 for your smaller companies maybe, and closer to 20-40% range for, you know, from 16 to 20. And the things that they were denying it on, it's just, you know, all of these, you know, there's very little black and white to law. Most of it is gray area things. That's why, you know, Congress said something black and white, but the regulations get into the gray and the executive orders get into the even grayer areas. And so what we saw basically, big picture, what we saw from the Trump administration last time was a real stress testing of all these gray areas in immigration law. What is a specialty occupation? What is specialized knowledge for L1 purposes? So a lot of these things that kind of like are difficult to quantify, easier to make into like a beauty contest a little bit. We found like, well, this is not a specialty occupation because, you know, it's not a job that normally requires a bachelor's degree. Or we saw, for example, some, and that, like, oh, this job is a level 1 wage. That, you know, we're going to use some mental gymnastics to say level 1 does not translate to a specialty occupation. So there were a lot of weird curveball things like that, that maybe we could expect some new innovative curveballs in the future when it comes to that. Right to control is an issue that sort of got inoculated. It started, you know, unironically with Obama, the right to control issue in 2010, and sort of ended with a really cool lawsuit and settlement agreement in 2020. That's based on a regulation. That's something that they can try to go back to notice and comment to try and reinterpret what right to control means. And can we get into the client documentation? Probably the biggest thing though is that, like, I think Jeffrey got to it, mentioned it earlier, was the whole deference thing. The reversal on deference meant that higher RFE issuance rate. I think my statistic is still true that I've done more RFE responses in from 16 to 2020 than in my entire other career combined. And I've been, you know, doing this since 2010 as a lawyer and since 2007 as a paralegal. So, and counting all those cases, I think it's more volume during that 4-year window than those other 10 years combined. And so, you know, making it more difficult to obtain, it's a way to push policy without changing law. I'm going to make this so difficult to obtain that maybe that's just going to turn off some users to the experience, and they're going to be dissuaded from even participating in the program. And I guess last thing is that I'll touch on is about the H4 EAD. So this is also a regulatory gift, I guess, from the Obama administration. There were no H4 EADs before 2015, and then regulation notice and comment, and now it's a work authorization that's available. And again, that putting that toothpaste back in the tube might have been too much work for the Trump administration that first go around. So instead of, I think that was a political talking point, we're going to get rid of H4 EADs, but they didn't actually do it. They just made them really hard to get, or the processing time really increased for them.
The whole thing was just like delaying tactics. And so if you can't change the law,
exactly,
you can do certain things to make it drag things, as Kevin's just explaining, so you can try to figure out how to, I guess, game the system to achieve a result that is very unpleasant for those who are going through it, but satisfies and meets your agenda, and you don't have to deal with potential lawsuits, because unless, I guess, you're sued with writs of mandamus, et cetera. Besides the H-1Bs and the H-4s, which, of course, impact a lot of our employer and employee, you know, going through the H-1B and the green card process, there's a bunch of changes that have occurred with consular processing. Maybe, Jeffrey, you could just touch upon some of those, just to sort of share, give us a flavor.
Yeah, sure. So on the consular processing end, there are some things that we saw in the past and other, you know, proposed policies that, you know, didn't actually go into effect, but, you know, could give an indication of what to expect in the future. So for one, and Sheila, you mentioned this before about generally slowed processing times for, you know, visa applications, and that was particularly true with the consulates. At the beginning of the Trump administration, there was an initial suspension of the non-immigrant visa interview waiver program. I think that was reinstated at a certain point, but, you know, perhaps that could be there. Something could happen regarding the interview waivers in the future. There were various policies aimed at, you know, increasing the vetting of visa applicants, and often targeted to the individual applicant's country of origin. There was a proclamation by President Trump to also require certain immigrants to prove that they were that they would be eligible for healthcare coverage within a certain amount of time after entering the United States, or that they would be able to cover their healthcare costs. This never actually went into effect because it was blocked by the federal courts. There were, I think, two lawsuits, and one got overturned, but one injunction stayed in place. So that's just an interesting thing that happened. And finally, there was a proposed regulation at the end of the Trump administration to create a presumption against recommending waivers of the 2-year home residency, home country, you know, residence requirement for J non-immigrants. So there's a general, you know, targeting of these waivers that occurred, you know, during the Trump administration.
Right, the no objection and exceptional hardships for J non-immigrants. So they were trying to do that, you know, absolutely put a black and white. But in reality, a lot of the medical doctors are working in medically underserved areas and health professional shortage areas that will actually end up greatly impacting people in middle America, in Appalachia, in places which have a huge need. So in a way, I guess it's good that it didn't work out. But, you know, we're just trying to share flavors of what we think could occur on the horizon if there was to be another Trump presidency, right? So the next topic that we want to touch upon, sort of being very mindful also of the time that we try to wrap these up within 30 minutes or so, or 40 minutes, are the potential changes that we would briefly discuss to employment-based or family-based immigration and adjustment of status. So as, you know, we've kind of already alluded to in the discussion with Kevin, Jeffrey, and myself, you know, previously under the Trump administration, there was there were mandated interviews for every single employment-based and family-based adjustment of status applicant. And this obviously increased the workload with local USCIS offices, field offices, and slowed down tremendously processing of adjustment of status applications. And so now majority of employment-based 485 interviews are waived. And also the Trump administration had limited the availability of interview waivers for marriage-based conditional permanent residents. Remember, if your marriage is less than 2 years to a U.S. citizen or permanent resident, by the time you get your permanent, you know, to get the card, you would file the waiver of your two-year home residency, or like similar to the two-year home residency, you would file the waiver, the conditional removal on the conditions. Well, in appropriate cases where there was tons and tons of documentation provided, the local office of the USCIS could waive that interview. But then again, they were making it mandatory to interview every single candidate rather than allow the interview waivers. There was also a proposed rule, if you recall, back in 2018, to end the concurrent filing of immigrant petitions and 485 adjustment of status. So again, this would have greatly impacted status, because now when people file their 485 and they get the EAD, they can stop extending the H-1B or the L-1 or whatever non-immigrant status the person was on. And finally, you know, the topic I'm going to touch briefly upon, of course, is parole powers. They continue to be a target of conservative policies, whether it's humanitarian parole, advanced parole, because it was common back in the prior Trump administration to deny most advanced parole applications if you departed the U.S. without actually having the valid advanced parole in hand. That was never usually a problem before. It was like, yeah, kind of, if you applied for it, fine, but not now. And that policy has continued to this day to impact and really mess up a lot of people's lives. And so this policy obviously continued through the Biden administration, but it's an indicator of how certain parole benefits or powers, as they may be, could be curtailed by an administration under a new Trump administration. And also the Biden administration, as you recall, just a few months ago, just started issuing 5-year advanced parole and EAD combined documents in most cases. Again, that could be in jeopardy if there's a Trump administration, because they want to minimize it and make sure that there's no continuity for people, right? Also TPS, temporary protected status for numerous countries would also be in jeopardy or impacted. And what about the other issues, Kevin, that we expect with adjustment of status, public charge, all those kinds of issues?
Yeah, definitely. Well, when we saw a lot of forward movement, I guess also like mainly for like EB3, those EB3 downgrades that we did in early 2020, when we filed those 485 applications, that was the first time that we had to really address that on a large scale way with the Trump administration, whether this the applicant would become a public charge, you know, like have to rely on public benefits, taxpayer funded benefits was a big indicator. It's always been on the books that that's something that, you know, is a basis for inadmissibility. But the scrutiny on, you know, and analyzing that went up exponentially. And the amount of trees that sacrificed themselves for immigration benefits that year was tremendous. You had to include the credit reports and bank statements and, I mean, things that even loan officers would not even ask for such, you know, so much stuff, in addition to medical record, medical exam and all those other things. So a lot, again, this theme of more administrative hoops, this theme of getting paying more for less. You know, I think the fees are probably going to go up if there's it probably would go up either way, but, you know, it's like how much they'll go up and how much you're going to get back in return for that. Like your example, Sheila, of, you know, maybe you can only get a 1-year advanced parole instead of a 5-year for the same fee. That's a 5x increase because of the frequency that you have to apply for that benefit. Another thing I just thought of that I remembered was like with the H-1Bs, if they start looking at the work orders for those people working on client-based projects, remember when they were shortening the duration to being like 3 and 6 and 1, 3, 6 months, yeah, or 1 year duration, yeah, instead of the 3-year? Now you're spending, mm-hmm, you know, the thousands of dollars times three for the same benefit. So, you know, these are the administrative tools in the tool closet if you want to apply a more conservative agenda, a more liberal agenda, a more pro-business agenda, a more anti-immigrant agenda that we've seen being tinkered with over the last, in my life, for me, three administrations, for Sheila, for many more. But still the same tools in the toolbox, right? Just what they want to do with the engine.
Exactly. And there was also some type of changes impacting the U.S. Department of Labor for Farm and H-1. Maybe, Jeffrey, you could just touch upon it briefly.
Yeah, sure. So the Department of Labor doesn't get a lot of attention in broader immigration conversations. You know, people are typically focused on the consulates or USCIS, but the Department of Labor plays a critical role with, you know, both the perm process and H-1B, and specifically with determining the prevailing wage or, you know, the wage level for a given position. And at the end of the Trump administration, there was a proposed rule that never went into effect, but this rule would have changed the way wage levels are calculated for both perm and H-1B. And essentially what this would have done is, you know, on the H-1B side, the wage level recalculation would have increased the wage per each wage level. So there are four wage levels, and so for H-1B, if the required wage that would have to be paid to the employee would have gone up. So that's in the short term. And in the long term, the perm process is all about, you know, the future position, that the sponsored employee will work in once they get their green card. And the prevailing wage determination is the wage that needs to be paid to the employee at that time. And it's an important consideration for employers, you know, having the ability to pay that wage and ultimately paying it. And with the new calculation, that offered wage would have increased too.
Yeah, exactly. So like Kevin was saying, with the, you know, 944s, the public charge provisions, this was the 18-page form attached to the 485, which almost made it like lawyers were like, this is like a brand new process from, I mean, it's like more complicated than doing an entire adjustment of status application from beginning to end, because you had to look at literally stacks and stacks and stacks of financial documents. So the whole goal is to dampen immigration, to restrict it, to prevent people from coming, to, you know, eliminate family-based immigration, to add more hurdles and roadblocks, because the feeling, again, is part of the, remember, protectionist, build the walls around America, forget about, it's interesting, we like exporting stuff to other countries, and we don't want to import. So, you know, we want to have policies that help us, yet we'd like to use other countries to benefit our policies. But unfortunately, whatever it is, the world is flatter, we are more technology-driven, we are interdependent on each other. And so I think we were trying to come up with what are some of the possible ways to counter these restrictive policies, maybe challenge them or what have you. Kevin, do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, again, looking back to 2016 to 2020, I think, the first is just experience and dealing with whatever the changes are as they come. If you're filing your green card and your H-1B and, you know, your cases, and you have the same kind of RFE arguments in 2015 as you do in 2020, as you do in 2025, you're not keeping up, you know, with the times and the policies. It's a constantly adaptive process. And we've been making America boring again. And when it comes to our area in the last 4 years, it has not been a need for rapid adaptation because it's not been as high stress, you know, uncertainty with things. But just like, you know, in nature, when there are more uncertainty, more predators, whatever, you have to adapt to those situations. So first they need to happen. You know, why is this being denied? Take a look at it. How can we adapt and change for the next filing? But I think another more potent tool now that was not on the table as much in the last Trump administration is litigation in a much bigger way, because of the Supreme Court decision, Loper-Bright Enterprises, that, you know, killed Chevron deference. So this is the idea that for, you know, I would, when I went to law school, and for, you know, Chevron was the rule of the land, and it was, you know, deference to the agency. If the agency interprets something, if it's a reasonable interpretation, you know, we're going to defer to the agency when you bring that kind of case to a federal court. Now the courts say, no, we don't have to give deference to the agency. We can just like independently look at that. And that's like opening a whole new arsenal, I think, of litigation opportunity to strategize, because again, policies will continue to change over presidencies, regardless of the change in law. And, you know, that should be like a Loper Bright red flag there. It's like, well, why is this like this now when it wasn't like this before? Here's my Loper Bright lawsuit. You know, I do think that for better or worse, litigation is probably going to be more involved in these requests for immigration benefits.
Exactly. With APA lawsuits, writs of mandamus, because of excessive delays, separating spouses or children of citizens, all of those kinds of issues. So the one good piece of news, because I think a lot of particularly individuals, but also employers, people from other countries always are afraid, like, oh, if I file a lawsuit, will the government come after me? We have never seen the government retaliate against an individual or an employer for filing a lawsuit, even under the Trump administration, because that's the American way. It's part of democracy. If there's excessive delays, you have to hold the government's feet to the fire, and that includes challenging them on incorrect denials, improper, unlawful, or excessive delays in processing of your cases. So to try and wind this up,
in fact,
you know, we all know.
Just real quick, Sheila. In fact, sometimes the company or, you know, whomever that files the lawsuit has a reputation of filing lawsuits, and they say, well, let me get a supervisor to look at this before we, you know, so it might give them pause to give a, you know, maybe a lazy, incorrect decision when it's a client, it's a user that's, you know, somebody that's known for not being afraid to use litigation.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. I tell people, you want to be a doormat, or you want to tell them, I don't take nonsense from anybody, including the federal government. I think believing in yourself, believing in your rights, challenging the government. I know several employers, agencies, or organizations that I have spoken to over the years have completely changed their outlook and their perspective and pursued loss litigation as one approach, because there is a sense of comfort and confidence knowing that there is really no major risk to you as employers or organizations in challenging the federal government. So to try and sort of conclude, you know, obviously we all know that in the U.S. there's a change, potential change every 4 years with a new president, a new administration, new immigration laws, policies, interpretations, because it usually is top down with the philosophy of the individual who is the president, right? Of course, because the United States continues to remain a land of opportunity, it's a much sought after place as a nation of immigrants, people from all over the world do want to make America their home. And to me, it's a great testament. And if people still want to come, it's a good sign that we are still an attractive place to live and work, a good economy that is chugging right along. But understanding which immigration law policies are susceptible to changes, what could happen to you, whether you're an employer, an employee, an individual, an organization, how do you navigate those changes to come up with policy? You know, that you really need people who are at the top of their game, that understand this, that build it in when we prepare your petitions, H-1s or L-1s or green card cases, because we're constantly monitoring this, all of these changes at the Mufti Law Firm. Because we've been doing this for over 30 years here in the United States, over 20 years with MuftiIndia.com for visa-related and other related issues at Mufti Immigration Services Private Limited. I joke about 30 plus 20, 50 years together. We've been doing it. Multiple presidential administrations. I've been practicing immigration law for almost 40 years, right? I guess I date myself. But again, our goal is always to protect our clients, whether it's employers, employees, individuals, families, so that we can help to make their dream of living and working in what I still think is the greatest country on earth a reality. So, you know, our goal, it is our vision and our mission at the Mufti Law Firm to help that magic happen. And we certainly hope to continue to educate you, empower you, and enlighten you as you try to figure out how you should organize yourselves as employers or individuals to navigate these sometimes troubled, churning waters, and how we can bridge that to make all of this work well. So next, we hope maybe in the next month or two to touch upon Kamala Harris's immigration policies if we get more insights or and continue to do more research on this. And just to wrap up, I want to say on behalf of Kevin Andrews, Jeffrey Galkin, myself, Sheila Murthy, and the entire Murthy Law Firm team, we want to thank you for joining us for today's discussion on potential impact of a Trump administration on U.S. immigration policies. And we look forward to continuing to educate and empower you with respect to other changes that may appear on the horizon. Have a wonderful rest of the day and take care. Bye-bye.
This is a free service. The content is the protected, copyrighted property of the Murthy Law Firm. Unauthorized recording or dissemination of these materials without prior permission is prohibited by law. Learn about our firm, how to engage our services, and more at www.murthy.com.